Some of you may know Ken Alexander, who is the chief counsel for the Emory Hospital System, traveled with our group last year, and he was instrumental in setting up this meeting with Rabbi Rosel, who has been very gracious to meet with us. And I've just learned from Avril that this is the oldest Jewish community organization in Israel?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about that, so that you know where you are at least.
But thank you very much for it.
It's a great pleasure. I don't know actually what I'm doing other than we're meeting you, so I actually don't know what you want me to speak about. But maybe if I just make an initial introduction, you'll see. And very often I must tell you that despite my accent, you can tell that I imagine you can tell that I was born in Britain. But despite my accent, I work for an American organization, and therefore I'm in the States much more than any other part of the English-speaking world. And I've discovered that that's where the cutting edge of the English language really is. And I'm discovering new words all the time. And recently I was introduced as a well-known dialogian. I had never heard this word, dialogian. They explained to me it means a theologian who is involved in dialogue is a dialogian. Okay? But in my experience, most dialogians are actually monologians. But I'm very happy to be a dialogian, and therefore unless you have anything specific in mind, whether you prefer to be, regardless, maybe the best thing to do is after I've introduced both this place and myself and what I do, and you can pick up on those different aspects that you'd like to engage me more in, and then we can have proper dialogue. Whether you prefer these to be theological, which is fine, I'm your captive rabbi for what, do we have an hour? I'm your captive rabbi, so it can be any theological question. I'm also, even though I have no authority to express my opinion on political matters, not being qualified or not having authority has never stopped me from expressing my opinion. you can ask me any question you like. I'm at your disposal. But so first of all, let me tell you about this place, and therefore about the organization. This building is in effect, if you like, the consulate of AJC. AJC prefers to call itself AJC rather than American Jewish Committee, because even though it's American, it has pretensions to be global. Doesn't every American organization? AJC is the oldest Jewish advocacy or human relations organizations in America, the oldest Jewish American advocacy organization. In typical American fashion, you don't have one of anything. And especially in typical Jewish fashion, you don't have one of anything. You may have heard the witticism, if you have two Jews, you have three opinions. Well, it's the same with Jewish organizations. We have lots of different organizations that try to do the same thing. But, so first of all, this organization, AJC, claims venerability of age, and therefore assumption of some kind of greater wisdom by virtue of that age, which is not always borne out in fact. But we have 30 chapters across the United States, those like regional offices. It's a membership organization. And it seeks to represent, it was founded, and its purpose is to represent the Jewish agenda, in a sense, what an advocacy organization means. But it was actually originally established by American Jews of West European origin, especially German, who were very concerned when the mass immigration of Jews from Eastern Europe started coming into America. Both concerned that this immigration of a less sophisticated, cultured, and educated population may have a deleterious impact upon their interests, but also in order to help facilitate the integration of those Jews into American life. And therefore, their main area of engagement was first and foremost internal. And the issues that AJC focused upon from its inception were issues that relate to church and state in the United States, relationship between religious communities and the civic authorities, and to be able to advance the well-being of the community. What probably instinctively Jews understood from their own experience, and AJC certainly understood, is that if you want to advocate the well-being of one minority group in a democracy, then the most effective way to do that is to advocate for all minorities. And therefore, AJC quickly became a human relations organization, working to combat all prejudice and bigotry and then to advance the well-being of all communities in the United States. And one of the greatest, I would say, the greatest blessing is very interesting, if I may now give you a little Talmudic quote. The Talmud says that the word Torah is often used by Jews in maybe three senses. One, the word Torah means instruction, and in its most basic term it means instruction in the Pentateuch, and therefore the word Torah is used for the five books of Moses. But Torah is also used as to refer sometimes to the Bible, and very often to the whole of Judaism. So it can be used in different ways. In the Talmud, the sages of the Talmud say that Torah is like Torah can be both the elixir of life and the drug of death. It's an amazingly powerful comment, and I think that's true about religion generally. Religion can be the most wonderful blessing, it can be the most destructive curse. And we see that very much in this part of the world, but we see it all over the world. And how on earth did I get onto that? There must have been some train of thought. Oh yes, and therefore, AJC in its early days, I had a very late night last night, so please forgive me. And if there's anything that's not clear, or if I'm beginning to slur my words or something, please stop me and send me back. So AJC realized that one of the most significant factors in determining how people relate to one another, and certainly in terms of Jewish experience, one of the worst sources of prejudice and bigotry and of hatred has actually been religion. Such a tragedy, of course, in terms of the history of religion. And therefore, if you want to be able to advance your own well-being, you've got to deal with those issues about prejudice and bigotry within religion. And therefore, interreligious affairs quickly became part of AJC's agenda. And then, as the United States became more and more significant on the world stage, and especially after the establishment of the State of Israel, so AJC got involved more and more in the area of international relations. And I don't know how many years ago, it must be about 30 years ago, the AJC established, made an office here in Jerusalem that they called the Middle East Office. And in a way it was prescient when the peace process began, because we actually thought that we were entering into a new Middle East. Unfortunately, many of our dreams and naive optimism have been dashed in that regard. But the idea of this office was to be able to be, as I say, a consulate for American Jewry and American society generally, but especially in terms of the Jewish interests here in Jerusalem. And that means both in relating to governments and to Israeli society, in terms of Israel diaspora relations, relationship between American Jews and Israeli Jews, to get to know one another, to be able, therefore, to bridge sometimes a gulf of understanding, of misunderstanding. So that's why this office was established. And this office is directed by my colleague, Rabbi Ed Rettig, who is a Reform rabbi. I'm an Orthodox rabbi, but some of my best friends are Reform. And though we like to think that we actually here show an example, I'll tell you a little more in that in a moment. Now, I mentioned AJC has therefore essentially four divisions, I mentioned three. Domestic policy, international relations, interreligious affairs, and I didn't mention Jewish life, which interestingly enough was the last of those four sections to be established to try to help promote or to look at issues of contemporary Jewish life. Now, all the heads of those departments are all in the United States. Two in New York and one in Washington. And the head of the Interreligious Affairs Department, logically, should be in the United States. But I was taken on to head that whole Department of Interreligious Affairs, and I do not sit, I sit here in Jerusalem. And therefore, this office serves not only as the Israel office, but it serves also as the office for our international interreligious affairs activities. Now that's what AJC pays me to do. Fortunately, I have a US director who therefore handles all the relationships with the chapters in the United States and issues in the United States, and AJC pays me to run around the world, fly around the world, playing the role of ambassador for Judaism for religions of the world. I hope I do some good, but I have a hell of a lot of fun. And I've just come back from Doha yesterday. Was it yesterday? I think so. And before Doha, I'd been in London. So they used to say, I believe during the Second World War, join the army and see the world. Join interfaith relations, see the world. It's much more fun, much more stimulating, I think, much more fascinating. And so here in Israel and the Holy Land, I'm very much involved with leadership. We've managed to form, for the first time ever, coming out of the historic meeting in Alexandria in 2002, a Council of Religious Institutions of the Holy Land, which is the first time ever in history that brings the religious leadership of both Palestinian, of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish communities together, which is in itself, especially in the present political circumstances, a miracle, and amazing that it manages to hold. The constituents, therefore, are the Sharia courts of the Palestinian Authority, the Ministry of Awqaf, the Ministry of Religious Affairs, the Chief Rabbin of Israel, all the patriarchates and the bishoprics. And this council has been formed with three declared purposes: to keep open avenues of communication between religious leadership and try to troubleshoot and therefore calm the waters and combat incitement, and that relates to the second area, to do what it can, therefore, to fight against combat defamation and misrepresentation of any one religion and its adherents. And here we've got at least some success story to report, at least a success process, I should say. And the third is that all these leaders declare their commitment to peace and want to support the resolution of conflict here so that two nations and three religions can live side by side in security and in respect for one another. And if you would ask even most people in this country, let alone in the world, they will tell you that not only have they never heard about this, they don't even believe it, because the assumption is that religion is somehow hostile to any kind of resolution of the political conflict here. A totally maximalist. And here all, now, it's true, these religious leaders don't have exactly the same view of the end game, nor do they have the same view of how you go to that particular end game, but they are all declare that they want peace. And everybody here speaks about peace. Just getting to it is rather difficult because everybody wants it on their terms. But nevertheless, I think that one of the biggest failures of any political initiative here has been the failure to take religion seriously. In a way, maybe it's taking religion a little too seriously, but it's not taking it seriously enough when it comes to the understanding of necessity to engage religion in any political initiative. All political initiatives here, like the historic Oslo process, have avoided anything to do with religion. Or let me give you an illustration to try to make it a little more visible. On the lawn of the White House, when a famous handshake took place between Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, there was no identifiable Palestinian Muslim or Palestinian Christian religious figure. There was no identifiable Israeli Jewish religious figure. The message implicit is not more than that, but I think in fairness to Bill Clinton it was implicit, maybe even unconscious, was: you religious people keep out of this, because you're only going to mess things up. We secular people, we know how to be able to resolve a conflict, because you're part of the problem, and you're part of the trouble. Now, it's not entirely untrue. When you see some of the terrible things that are done in the name of religion here, you can understand how people come to that conclusion. But it's a total fallacy to assume that because religion is the problem, the solution is having nothing to do with it. No, that's going to guarantee that the problem's going to get worse. Because all aspects of nature abhor a vacuum. And if you try to clear the table, all you're doing is you're inviting the extremists to occupy center stage. If you don't want the extremists to occupy center stage, you've got to engage the moderates. The vast majority of religious leadership here see themselves as moderate and want to be engaged, but they're not engaged because religion is seen as something of a problem. The fallacy is, if you don't want religion to be part of the problem, the answer is not to ignore it. The answer is to make it part of the solution. Not to replace politicians with religious leaders, God forbid, that would be catastrophic, but to engage religious leadership to support positive political initiatives. And that's not being done. Even under this administration, George Mitchell has been here a couple of dozen times, he hasn't met with a single religious leader. Not Christian, let alone Muslim or Jewish. And therefore, implicitly, they're passing on a message: you people are at best irrelevant, at worst, you're the enemy. And therefore, you're guaranteeing that religion is going to continue to be part of the problem, the cycle. And all the messages I've been trying to send through various sources, which I have been sending through, and I'm sure that they've reached George Mitchell, haven't had any effect. So there is this very profound prejudice. And this council of Palestinians and of Israelis wants to be engaged, but they're not being engaged. Actually, the one Paradoxically, maybe for many of us, the previous American administration did begin to engage, particularly Condoleezza Rice met with the Council a couple of times, and there have been meetings with the President of the Council of Europe and other things, but if the American administration, the current administration, doesn't engage the Council, the Council is not going to be seen as terribly significant. But the political engagement is only one area. The area that we can do something about is the area of incitement and images of the other. And the most important project of the Council, which is funded by the United States, is the first ever cooperative, comprehensive review of both Israeli and Palestinian textbooks. How the other is presented. And one thing that has never been looked at is images of the other's religion and how the religions are presented. And that we're looking at in some extensive, so this is a very big survey being led by a Palestinian and Israeli professor under the auspices of the Council, funded by the United States with a very big international academic council behind it. And we hope that maybe the Council can be some kind of branding, so that you can actually say the Council, the religious leadership could be seen to be supporting good initiatives, so that a little more visibility. But it's very difficult here. This is a high, both Palestinian and Israeli society are hyper-politicized societies. If you're not part of a political structure, then you don't get the visibility. So civil society here does not get the visibility it does in most democracies. This has to do with both the structure as well as the context in which we find ourselves. Well, I've gone on for much longer than I really wanted to at the beginning. Let me just quickly summarize by saying I have spent a little more time talking about my engagement here, because I imagine that interests you more than elsewhere. But I spend probably more than 50% of my time running to different parts of the world. And my engagement is not only with the Abrahamic faiths, but also with the Eastern world religions, both with Hinduism and Buddhism. I suppose, however, my greatest specialization is more specifically in Jewish-Catholic relations, because I was part of a team that negotiated the establishment of full relations between Israel and the Holy See. And until a year ago, I was chairman of the body that presumed to represent the whole Jewish world to other world faiths, which, of course, as I say, if you have two Jews, you have three opinions, and therefore that's a little bit of a joke, but it's the only structure we have. And it's the official partner of the Vatican and of the World Council of Churches, but there are all kinds of tensions with the World Council of Churches, but we have, and also with the Orthodox Churches, and we have with the Catholic Church and with the Orthodox Churches every 2 years formal bilateral gatherings. And then I'm actually the advisor and faith advisor to the Chief Rabbi of Israel, because that's, the Chief Rabbi of Israel just got involved in interfaith relations in the last decade in a big way. And even though I'm an Orthodox rabbi, I'm a modern Orthodox rabbi. That means I live in a modern world, I feel part of modern society. Most of my colleagues, Orthodox colleagues here in Israel, may be probably described as pre-modern Orthodox. And they're not terribly comfortable, don't really know the world outside, and therefore, how do they get involved in interfaith relations? Well, as I said, negotiations with the Vatican allowed the Pope, John Paul II, to visit in the year 2000. And when John Paul II was here, he asked for a special meeting with the Chief Rabbi of Israel. At this meeting he said, you know, there are international bodies for our relationship, but I work for the Jewish world and the Catholic world, but I would like to have a special bilateral commission between the Chief Rabbi of Israel and the Holy See. Chief Rabbi of Israel did not and does not have a committee for dialogue with other kinds of Jews, let alone with other religions. It had never occurred to them to have a committee for dialogue with the Holy See. But when a Pope asks you, it's rather difficult to say no. And therefore they needed somebody who at least has certain, if you like, institutional legitimacy with them, who at least knew the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant, if not between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. And therefore, as a result, I have been the continuous beneficiary of other people's ignorance. And that's why I've been able to bring the rabbinate into this activity, and now we have not only a bilateral commission with the Catholic Church, but also with the Anglican Communion, through the Archbishop of Canterbury. In fact, we just had our most recent meeting last week. And the Chief Rabbi has been involved in three world congresses of imams and rabbis for peace, which have been very interesting. Probably the next one will be next spring in India. And we've had Hindu-Jewish summits as well, and I've been able to facilitate all that. I was going to go internationally, but I got back here again. But very, very quickly, just to tell you then that I've been here, I should have started with this, but I'm going to finish with this. So I was raised in England, my rabbinic education here. I actually have my ordination from the heart of ultra-orthodoxy, the heart of the black country. I mean, black cyclops and black hats and black coats. And I was also chaplain to the Israeli Defense Forces in Western Sinai. In fact, I can claim to be Moses' successor, because in Jewish tradition we refer to Moses as Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our rabbi, the teacher, because a rabbi is a teacher. And to the best of my knowledge, between Moses and me, there was no rabbi on a regular basis in West Sinai. And now Israel's given Sinai back to the Egyptians, so we don't have much competition for the title. So. And then I was rabbi in South Africa. I was expelled by the apartheid regime, so very proud of that. And then I was chief rabbi of Ireland. And of course, as part of where my special affinity and engagement with the Catholic Church started, actually starting in South Africa, but especially in Ireland, where 95% of the country was Catholic, 5% was Protestant, and I was chief rabbi of the rest. No, but actually, the chief Ireland's a unique history. The first chief rabbi of Ireland was Rabbi Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel. But when I was there, there were more Jews in the Torah than there were Protestants in the Irish Parliament than there were Protestants, even though there were 100 times as many Protestants as Jews in Ireland, and have been Jewish Lord Mayors of all major cities. That was great fun, but that was 25 years ago. So I'm an old man already, so I've been back here 25 years, and as I say, having a lot of fun. Okay, so I think I will try to prove that I can be a dialogian by bringing my monologue to an end, and you are welcome to take me wherever you wish to go. Please.
Could you share the name of the council again?
Yes, thank you. In fact, there's a website, but I don't think it's managed terribly effectively, but at least if you go on, you'll get some information. So it's the initials of the Council of the Religious Institutions of the Holy Land, CRIHL.org. Now, why did it have such a cumbersome name? Because I mentioned in passing, and I don't know whether you picked it up, the real historic moment was in 2002, when the Second Intifada was at its height, when an initiative was taken by the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord George Carey. And thank God, indeed very providentially, Canterbury had an institutional, has an institutional relationship, even though it's rather weak at the moment, with Al-Azhar, the fountainhead of Islamic learning in Cairo. Now, why was that so important? Because one of the many problems we have here in terms of the asymmetrical relationship between the religions is that Islam here, and we're essentially in an Islamic Lebensraum, an Islamic environment, does not have really first-class scholarship and intellectual leadership. In fact, the Islamic community is rather impoverished. And there is a paradox here. You can't do anything in terms of interfaith relations or in terms of regional political resolution without Palestinian engagement and involvement, without them being central to it. And yet, and therefore, anything that relates to interfaith relations with the Muslim world is somehow going to, initially, somehow going to be affected by the Palestinian issue, and therefore by the presence or absence of Palestinian leadership. And yet, the actual Palestinian religious leadership, Muslim leadership, does not have the credibility in the Muslim world to be able to give any kind of leadership. So here's an irony, a paradox, a catch-22. It's a very difficult situation. So one of the ways to do it is to make sure that initiative takes place with two prongs, that Palestinians are leading or in the forefront, but with the support and the partnership of major Muslim credibility. And that was where Al-Azhar was so important. So through Al-Azhar working together with then, unfortunately, a man who passed away very young, who was a most wonderful and remarkable individual, who may not have been a world-class Muslim scholar, but as a human being, was a man of enormous courage and vision. He had been a Hamas leader, repented of his ways, and became a minister in the Palestinian Authority's government. And he was mandated by Yasser Arafat to lead the Palestinian delegation. And his name was Sheikh Talal Sidr. But he had a stroke and died, as I say, very young. The other person is a more problematic person, who is the head of the Sharia courts of the Palestinian Authority, Sheikh Tamimi. He was the one who sort of did a did a dirty on the Pope when the Pope Benedict XVI came, and you may actually did it also to John Paul II, and caused a whole fracas at the interfaith meetings, and stormed out and made and screamed and shouted, and therefore caused a certain amount of embarrassment there. But he nevertheless occupies that position. And they were the two key persons who represented Palestinian Islamic leadership at the gathering in Alexandria. But the fact that Sheikh Tantawi, who passed away a few months ago, the then head of Al-Azhar, was there as the official religious host, gave our gathering Islamic authenticity and credibility. So the problem wasn't in terms of our gathering on the Christian side nor on the Jewish side. Even though there are problems there, I mean, the chief rabbin of Israel doesn't really represent most Israelis, not even most religious Israelis. But in the same way, the most muftiates are not considered to be representative by most Muslims. They're considered to be figureheads in each situation. But that's what you have to work with. In the case of the Jewish community, though, it's not just a question of representation, it's the fact that Orthodoxy doesn't represent the Jewish world. It's dominant here, but not in the United States. The United States Orthodoxy is probably maximum 10% of Jewry. So there are all kinds of problems in terms of representativity, but nevertheless, the Jewish community, Christian communities, even those who wouldn't agree with the ideology of the Christians or the Jews there, wouldn't have a problem if they're representing them for a good cause. But in the Muslim case, it had to be significant Muslim authority if it was going to have any kind of support from the Muslim world, and therefore Al-Azhar was crucial, and that's why we had to meet in Egypt. And therefore, and it was hosted in Alexandria, and we had the cooperation of all the political leadership. Probably this was under still the impact of September the 11th, 2001, and a desire of political leaders to show that they were on the side of good religion as opposed to bad religion. There was a little window there. So we had the support of Mubarak, as well as Arafat, and Ariel Sharon. And a text that came out of our meeting was vetted, word for word, and therefore it ended up as a bit of a cavil, but it's still a historic text that condemns violence in the name of religion as a desecration of religion, was vetted and approved both by Sharon and Arafat. It's probably about the only thing they ever agreed upon. And this gathering in Alexandria was the first time ever in human history that the religious leaders of the Holy Land had come together, which is both pathetic and wonderful. I mean, pathetic that until 2002, the religious leaders of the Holy Land never ever come together. Wonderful that we were able to do it despite the conflict. So it is possible to do some amazing things despite everything going on around. Now, the strength of that gathering was its weakness. Because the strength was that all the personalities there, including one of Israel's chief rabbis, including two patriarchs, all of them who were there ad persona. In their own personal capacity, not, I don't know if there's such a phrase, but if not, I'm coining it, not ad institutionem, not on behalf of their institutions. And so when one died, like Talal Siddur, or when the chief rabbi's term here in Israel for 10 years, and then were replaced, there wasn't buy-in from their respective successors in all the areas. So what we, when we formed this council, and from the Christians' point of view, there was also an irritation that the Archbishop of Canterbury and his remarkable, outstanding secretary for these events, who is now Canon Andrew White, who is well known for his work in Iraq, in Baghdad today, there was a bit of resentment here that it was Christians outside who were pulling the strings. There's a lot of that resentment here for very understandable historic reasons, and therefore they wanted their own ownership. So for all these reasons, we needed to create a council of religious institutions of the Holy Land, right? Not personalities, even though it is made up of those personalities. So that's why it has that rather cumbersome name. I'm sorry it took a long time, but I think you might have found it of interest.
Yes.
Have I exhausted you already?
Could you tell us more about the agency's intentions with the World Council?
Yes, I can. As opposed to the Vatican and the Orthodox Church, Orthodox churches, the World Council of Churches is not, as you know, and probably you know better than me, is not a hierarchical structure. It is, more like a company with many departments. And therefore the General Secretary is essentially a manager rather than a director, really. And therefore, and often cannot necessarily exercise independent control of what a particular wing of the organization may be doing. Now, if there was a possibility to separate the different wings of the World Council of Churches and for interreligious affairs to have its own independent identity, then there would be less difficulties from the Jewish side. The unfortunate thing from the Jewish side is that all those different things get mixed in, and therefore the International Affairs Department, which is seen as not very objective and not very balanced and ad initio hostile to Israel's very existence by virtue of the kinds of statements that have been put out, impacts upon the interreligious area. And therefore the attitude, personally I think unfairly, the attitude of the Jewish interlocutors is to say, look, if you want to dialogue with us, and we would like to have that dialogue, then we need to see something more balanced coming out from your International Affairs Department. But the actual people in the interreligious area and the ecumenical affairs don't control the international affairs area, and therefore their motives and their interests are different. And in fact, this happens also in the United States often with councils of churches. In fact, when there have been issues where the Jewish communities want to engage different Protestant organizations with a structure, we have often found that the people working in international affairs don't even know the people in the same church working in the area of interreligious dialogue and ecumenical affairs. And often we've brought them together through our own particular engagement, which is, so there are, have been pluses and minuses, but it has all been affected by the way politics poisons so much in terms of anything relating to not only the location here, but any community that cares about people. And the problem, of course, now in the bigger picture, expanding that, is that people tend to fall in, and I mean all people, and especially my own community, into a zero-sum mentality, a zero-sum game. And therefore there's an assumption that if you care about Israel, you somehow have to be insensitive to the Palestinian plight. Or the reverse assumption, that if you care for Palestinian dignity and well-being, you have to somehow be hostile to Israel. And for as long as we're caught in that kind of zero-sum game, everybody's going to continue to suffer. And things are only going to get worse for Palestinians. Probably also for Israelis, but they'll get more worse for Palestinians. What will get us out of the cycle of demonization and of alienation is only when we learn the win-win approach. And only when Israelis can understand that only when Palestinians' dignity and aspirations for national self-determination are realized will Israel really be secure. And only when Palestinians realize that Israeli security is in the interests of Palestinian dignity and national aspirations, and when people from both sides tell their respective interlocutors, because we love you and care about you, that doesn't mean we don't care and don't love the other side. Only when people start getting that through their thick heads, and here we have very thick heads, and so do most people supporting us around the world, will we begin to break that cycle. And therefore, part of the problem is, you see, one of the things here, not only is everybody traumatized here for various different reasons, everybody here thinks they're the victim. We just see ourselves in different paradigms. Palestinians see themselves as weak and victims in the face of Israeli might and power. Israel sees itself as vulnerable in the face of a sea of Arab hostility, which Palestinians are fifth column, in which they've been attacked time again, and there's been violence and terrorism in their streets. And the Arab world sees itself as the victim of Western imperialism, colonialism, consumerism, globalization, everything. Everybody here feels that they are the victims of somebody else. And therefore, it's somebody else's responsibility to take the initiative. And therefore, also, we're all caught up in our traumas. And therefore, when anybody says something that is not empathizing with us, that just increases our sort of our lager mentality, our withdrawal. And when I say us, I mean now all of us. Muslims, Christians and Jews, all living in this land, we all need an enormous amount of love because we all have not only historical but contemporary traumas. And we are caught in that sense of vulnerability and victimhood. That's why we can't get out of it ourselves. Of course, we can't have things imposed upon us because that's going to make the cycle even worse. But we can't do it without the third party. That's why, and there's only one superpower in the world today, that's why the United States engagement is so crucial. But the United States is not seen as impartial. Personally, I'm not unhappy about that. Personally, I feel that if the United States didn't support Israel, we would be wiped off the map tomorrow. So there you are. You might think that I'm paranoid too, but you know the famous one, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not trying to kill me. But on the other hand, the United States can't deliver alone. That's why there needs to be cooperation. There seems to be a great opportunity today with the Arab League, the Arab Peace Initiative that comes from the Saudis. Should have been, together in the United States, there should have been immediate cooperation on both parties to be able to bring the local parties together in order for a regional resolution. I don't know why that hasn't been done. No, but I'm not a politician. But unfortunately, the World Council of Churches, because of its own local constituency, which is only Palestinian, plays into the zero-sum game and thus exacerbates the alienation. And then Jews in America might be very successful, but Jews in America are also still suffering from historical trauma. And I would say there's something else about American Jewry. American Jewry actually feels a profound sense of guilt. And even grandchildren today who are born in the United States almost acquire that sense of guilt by osmosis. And I'm not talking about the guilt of the classical Jewish mother type guilt. I'm talking of guilt over the Holocaust. Now, something people understand that the Holocaust is a trauma, but they don't quite understand how profound that guilt of our failure to save 6 million of our brothers and sisters goes into the Jewish psyche.
Survivor guilt,
yes. In that sense, we are all survivors. And therefore, the survivor guilt is there. And therefore, anybody who therefore talks in language and is seen as ab initio hostile to us evokes all those fears. And therefore, it just compounds our own cyclical victimization. And that's why criticism, which needs to be expressed, because there are plenty of things we do which are wrong, but needs to be expressed in a way that shows that there is genuine care. And that care needs to start a sentence, not end a sentence, which is often the case. So there's a problem here. If people really want to break through this zero-sum mentality and get us into a win-win agenda, we've got to learn how to speak to one another. And that's not a simple matter with regards to all the different communities here. And I'm afraid that the WCC, while the people in international affairs, I think, understand that, the people in international affairs don't. Yes.
I'd love to hear your perspective on two things. Continued Jewish settlement in the West Bank and the wall that separates the West Bank from Israel.
So I think that the whole settlement enterprise in the occupied territories is a disaster. It's a disaster for Palestinians, but it's a bigger disaster for Israel. Because at the moment, it's serving as a major obstacle, or has served as a major obstacle, for Israel's ability to pursue the goal that was the goal of the Oslo process, which was withdrawal from the territories. It is, I would say, a security risk for Israel, liability. It's an economic liability for Israel. And I think it's damaged the fibers of our society as well, in various different ways. I think that, certainly since Oslo, so we're talking since the 70s, since the 90s, our governments have all said that their intention is to be able to withdraw, and of course we did withdraw from areas 90% of the population, and from the Israeli narrative's point of view, it was Palestinian violence with all the bombings in the streets and the bus bombings, and people then, I mean, everybody was affected by that. I remember I myself was a minute away from death just downtown when a bus bomb exploded, and I was in my car, and my car was pushed into another car simply by the impact of the bus explosion, which was quite a distance away. There was another day when I thought I'd lost one of my daughters because I knew she was nearby. So this, of course, added to the enormous trauma, and therefore that led to the Israeli re-entry back into the West Bank in order to be able to put down the violence. Now, notwithstanding, all Israel's prime minister, even Ariel Sharon, have understood that in order to be able to guarantee Israel's survival, we've got to pull out of the West Bank. They've all understood that. The vast majority of Israeli citizens understand that. 70% say they want a two-state solution. No, that means they're getting us out of the West Bank. The question is, if they all know it, and if they all wanted to move to that, why have they not taken on the settler enterprise with greater rigor? Of course, Ariel Sharon did evacuate into all the settlements from Gaza. And of course, that, unfortunately, served to undermine all of us, who might be the majority, who want to get out of the West Bank. Why? Because Israel pulled out of Gaza, and instead of Palestinians in Gaza trying, focusing upon rehabilitating their society, it was used immediately as a base for launching missiles into Israel. And therefore, all of us who had advocated before unilateral withdrawal from the West Bank now look like idiots. And you can't advocate that anymore. Because you just can't. You just look absolutely ridiculous, because somebody will say to you, look what happened in Gaza, so you're going to pull out of the West Bank, and it's going to be a launching pad for rockets right directly. They don't even need to shoot them. They can just flick them with their fingers, and boom, that's the end of you. So you're crazy if you're going to do that. And it's a very difficult argument to be able to counteract. And but still getting back to the question, so the idea of unilateral withdrawal, which many of us would have wanted, is now simply not really very practical. However, definitely Barak and Olmert and even Ariel Sharon were willing, realized that it was necessary. I think Netanyahu does, but I'm not too sure. Realized that they had to pull out. The problem was that the settler enterprise, I can tell you how it happened and how it's grown almost at the sort of, almost as an extra political entity, extra governmental entity almost. But all of them realized they had to take on the settler community. Now, depending upon how we define the settler community, and if you talk about the Clinton parameters, and therefore essentially you redesign the 67 borders and therefore have a land swap, so you'll be able to integrate the majority of the settlement communities which are actually contiguous with the Green Line. You're talking about maybe 100,000 outside that, of whom probably 70,000 would be willing to relocate, and you may have 30,000 to take on. The 30,000 may not seem significant, but in a country of where you only have 6 million Jews, it's not and if they're really determined, it's not an insignificant issue to take them on. And evacuating those settlements in Gaza was very traumatic for Israeli society, because we haven't sort of been evacuated before, and it once again conjures up all those fears from the past. So the attitude of Israeli leadership has been, look, we're going to take on the settlers when we get a peace deal, but it would be crazy to start taking it on and creating all this before we've got a deal on the table. In the meantime, the settlers have been able to exploit that vacuum time and again. So, I think, however, that, all indications at the moment are that thanks to a number of what appear to be silly Israeli blunders, there is a much more rigorous enforcement of Israel's commitment not to continue to expand in the settlements. How are we doing time? We're okay? Yeah? And I think at the moment, settlements are not expanding. All the information seems to be that everything actually is frozen. Now, that freeze will not last indefinitely. That's why it's all the more critical that there is some political movement that then can enable Israeli government to take it on. But This is almost like the matchmaker situation. When he's ready, she's not, and when she's ready, he's not. So what happens is, that at the moments when it's possible to get Israel to move, when Israel is in a political situation to move ahead, you suddenly find a situation where Palestinian society isn't ready to move ahead. And then you have the civil war between Hamas and Fatah. And therefore, Palestinian society is split. And there's a question of whether they can deliver. And many people would argue that even today in the West Bank, Hamas is already stronger than Fatah. It's just in terms of public opinion. So that's not clear. And so then we have now another cyclical argument. Those of us who would describe ourselves as perhaps, if you like, on the left of the Israeli political spectrum would say, we need to give more leeway and more goodies to Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority, so that Palestinian society can see that there's something to be gained through negotiations rather than the violent option. And the counter-argument is the Palestinian Authority has shown that it can't deliver. It was kicked out of Gaza by Hamas. It is not able to control all the areas of incitement and violence. If you stop letting up, actually you're going to enable Hamas to become more effective in this. So this is a very difficult thing. We're in a situation of where basically, now let's look at the bigger picture, of where you have, on the bigger Palestinian-Israeli conflict, of where basically you have a competition over the ownership of the house. And the truth is, for a variety of different reasons, however you want to look at history, there's a very compelling argument that two families should live in the house. And therefore, the logical thing should be to divide up the house. However, from the Israeli perspective, the attitude is, look, whatever the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the claims, the family in this house doesn't want us to be here at all. And the moment we start moving out, they start basically shooting into our rooms. And therefore, we can't afford to take the risk here in terms of being able to divide up the house. Many of us would say, as I say on the more on the left wing, if you don't take the risk, you may not have a house at all left to be able to take. Time is not on your side. But the counter-argument is, you don't take risks with your life. And so there's a real bind in not knowing exactly which way to move. And that's why Israeli society is, generally speaking, extremely confused, frustrated, and fearful with the present situation, and doesn't see how to move out of the situation. And this situation was relevant with regards to the war. The war was the initiative of the left wing in Israel. The right wing, especially Ariel Sharon, did not want to build that separation wall. Why? Because the right wing in Israel still has fantasies of a unitary state, which incidentally many Palestinians have. Of course, how that would work out, both sides see very differently. But the right wing doesn't want to define its eastern border, unless you define it as the Jordan River. And they were fearful that if you build a wall, then essentially you're defining your eastern border, which is true. It was the left wing, the Labour Party, that said, we have to give our citizens some protection against this continuing terrorism that's coming into our streets and into our towns. And therefore, let's build a wall. And in the end, the public opinion was so great that the left wing of Israeli politics won, and the right wing agreed to build the wall. Now, if you ask me what I think about that, I think that a building of a wall, when facing the situations that Israel faced with urban terrorism, was not only right, it was morally obligatory to protect its citizens. The principle is right. The way it was done was, I think, substantially illegitimate. In other words, it should have been built along essentially the 67 lines, and it certainly should have been built so as not to interfere with Palestinian neighborhoods. Now, parts of it are, maybe even the majority, up the northern part of the wall, in many places it does do that. It's almost, in many places, directly on the 67 line, and it's not affecting it. But there are some areas where there has been, I think, illegitimate confiscation of Arab land, an area where it even separates streets and families. Now, why? Because this is handed over to the military, and the military's primary purpose is to protect. And therefore, the military's primary purpose is strategic. Where is the most strategically effective line that I can build on that is going to be protected? Okay. The high courts, and I think this is quite the glory of the independence of the courts in Israel, the high courts have, in three different places, ruled against the military and instructed the military to pull the wall down and to rebuild it in a manner that does not interfere with the Palestinians and enables them also in certain areas to be able to work their lands, which are sometimes prevented to by the wall. The High Court has ruled that way. The military hasn't yet done it. So there'll be another High Court. Eventually, it will get to be done. But this is part of the problem of bureaucracy. So, in the end, the wall may actually serve to have achieved exactly what the right wing didn't want it to achieve, and that is to define where Israel's eastern border will be. And, in fact, in terms of even negotiations that Olmert was having with Abu Mazen, this was more or less agreed, with land swaps to be able to compensate for certain areas. So in the long run, if we have political initiative, it may not be such a bad thing. Turned out to be such a bad thing. But in the meantime, there are people's lives who are directly affected by it, and horrendously. And therefore, we need, again, to get a political process going as soon as possible, so that wall will come down in places where it needs to come down.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
I really appreciated your perspective here. Two things. Why don't we hear this more out of the Israeli government? And also, is there any counterpart to your voice of moderation and an objective understanding on the Palestinian side?
Well, first of all, you don't hear it out of the current government because I'm not sure that the current government agrees with me on everything. but certainly, this is a... I think, you know, it depends who you listen to in terms of areas. I mean, if you just go online into Israel's most venerable daily newspaper, Haaretz, and you go to Haaretz online, you'll see this every day. And his comments are wide, and therefore they're, you know, you'll hear them right around the country. Governments, by definition, have to push a line. So wherever you're dealing with a government, it's not going to give you nuanced approaches. I mean, it's almost by definition for any government anywhere. But I think you've had, certainly in the past governments under Olmert and a little bit, I think you would have had if Livni would have come in, and even under Sharon, who did enormous political, I wouldn't say 180 degree turn, but a significant turn. I would say these voices are not unusual here. I mean, the paradox is that here in Israel, we have very robust debate, very often aggressive, stormy debate, but all opinions are expressed, and nothing is forbidden territory to tread on. Outside, you get a different impression. And outside, people don't always seem to be as nuanced in their approach as here. But I suppose that's everywhere. If I think back to my period in Ireland, especially at the height of the Troubles, the language in the United States sounded absolute weird to us in Ireland. I mean, it would be almost jingoistic that we hear it, whereas in Ireland there was much more criticism and debate and subtlety going on in terms of those areas. So I think this is a much more general reality. Your second question is a more depressing one. Because obviously, the longer the more matters deteriorate, or the longer matters are in stalemate, the more difficult it is for those who are suffering, and that goes on both sides, but obviously more for the Palestinians, to be able to express moderate views. And there is a lot of intimidation today. And if you, especially in religious circles, if you stand up in a mosque and in the West Bank and advocate for peace and dialogue, if you get out there still without being bruised and damaged, if not more serious, you're not likely to be invited back to speak again. And in fact, even amongst the NGOs, there's a virtual excommunication of Israelis at the moment with regards to NGO cooperation, where there used to be enormous flourishing of Palestinian-Israeli cooperation. And there is still some of it. Officially, for example, a meeting of journalists, Israeli and Palestinian journalists, led to four journalists being expelled from the Palestinian Journalists Union. So there's an attitude of excommunication and of boycotts and extremism, which is a reflection of the degree of frustration within that society. I understand it. And in a sense, with regards to Palestinian society itself, I can empathize with it. I can't empathize with it when it's coming from people outside. People outside should be able to be detached enough to look at the situation in a manner that's going to be constructive for its inhabitants. I understand that when you're caught up in a fight, you're not always behaving intelligently. Passions get high, and you're caught up at the moment, and people behave the way they do. But for people from the outside, they should be able to behave, I would say, a little more responsibly. So one of the ways that we do things is we try to encourage those outside to be able to invite Palestinians and Israelis to come together, to be able to help them do certain joint initiatives. We need more and more of that. Unfortunately, one of the most wonderful Muslim voices in the old city of Jerusalem just passed away 2 days ago from a heart attack. And I think that this Sheikh Bukhari who passed away was, in many respects, it was a result of recent events which have led to a certain degree of depression. The great hope here is that we are a volatile society, not only for worse, but also for better. Things can change very quickly. And just like when Sadat came overnight, you know, Israelis were in love with Egyptians instead of seeing them as the enemy. So always here, things can change very rapidly, but they won't change without determination from outside forces. And if it's not coming from the United States in particular, then we're not going to see much change here. Please.
Can you help us understand a little bit more why America cares so much? And I want you to separate that from Jews who are in America. So I want to speak more on just the secular.
Yeah, I think that's important to do so, because I do not buy the argument that America does anything because of a Jewish lobby. Mm-hmm. When it comes to elections, maybe these factors do come in a little bit, but that's getting less and less, especially as the Jewish population is declining. I would say the electoral factor is not so dominant. But I think anything America does in this region is because of any American administration actually thinks it's in America's interests. Now, the big thing is there are a number of factors. I mean, there are probably as many of you here who have as good insights, if not better, on this in answer to the question than I have. But there are some obvious things. First of all, there are things that are openly stated. Things that are openly stated are the foundation of American identity in its democratic institutions, and therefore its identification with democracies more than societies that are not democratic. This is by no means a perfect democracy, but it is an extremely rugged one. And it's quite amazing when you consider that 90% of this population don't come from democratic societies. I'm not just talking of Jews who come from Arab lands, from the Middle East, from North Africa, from Asia, but even Jews who come from Europe, come from Central and Eastern Europe overwhelmingly, from places that were not democratic. And they've come into a situation of military, political, economic, social tensions that could have torn a mature democracy into smithereens. And still, it's an incredibly robust democracy. So that, I think, impresses America. And that also gives America a sense that this is someone in which, or a state in which they can have a degree of confidence. Because it's much more difficult to have confidence in authoritarian and totalitarian states. So I think that's a very important factor. And why particularly here? Because this is our, if you like, this is our curse for the Jewish people. Is that we have been a little bit too much at the center of global history for our own good. In once upon a time, it had to do with the fact that this little piece of land connected the three continents. And therefore, if you were the Assyrian Empire, or you were the Persian Empire, or you were the Greek Empire, or you were the Roman Empire, you wanted this piece of land. So we were in everybody's ways, and we were a bit of a stiff-necked people who wanted to maintain our own religion identity, and that got very irritating for people. So they were either putting us down, they were either kicking us out, or they were trying to incorporate us in certain ways, but we seem to have, for a tiny little people, far too dominant and visible in terms of imperial interests and history. Now, today it's got nothing to do with land connection, because today you don't need land connection. But what it, unfortunately, we are at an interface between the, certainly the Arab Muslim world and the Western world. We're right on the interface. And this issue, especially relating to Palestinians, serves as a lightning conductor for all the complexes and issues in terms of Arab and Muslim world, the Western world, in terms of history, even going back to the Middle Ages. So even if you listen to the rhetoric, it's being used by both sides as if we are somehow pawns in somebody else's service. So George W. Bush uses the term crusade. That immediately evokes within the Muslim world all the horrors of the Middle Ages, and we are then presented as the tools, the bridgehead of the crusaders. Listen to Osama bin Laden, it's basically the same thing. Basically, that's the bad world, and Jews are the bridgehead, and they're the ones who have just come into that particular area. So the extremists playing to those particular images, and this particular location gets disproportionate coverage, but it is at the interface, and therefore it is something that has strategic meaning. And if you don't have enormous confidence in the other regimes in the area, then their relationship with this little democracy has also regional, if not global, strategic ramifications too, in terms of being able. So I think there are historic cultural aspects we'll come back to. There are strategic interests that both lead America to be able to see the potential here. In recent times, we have become a little mini technological superpower ourselves. So there's enormous in the area, we are a sort of little Silicon Valley ourselves, so there's enormous value also for American-Israeli technological cooperation. It's not one way anymore. So that's another fascinating new development. But then there's one area that I haven't mentioned, which is the area which, within this particular context, I should mention most of all. And that is that America, as a society, has a very biblical foundation. And therefore, for large sections of American society, this is not a totally alien place. This is a place that has been associated with childhood narratives and with faith community narratives. And therefore, there's an interest and a connection here in different ways. Now, this doesn't have to be exclusively in terms of evangelical millenarianism or dispensationalism or these things. It can come simply out of a sense of a strong biblical association and interest, a familiarity with a certain people, maybe sometimes an overcoming of a certain historical anti-Semitism, also areas, but all these things then lend into, I'd say, a particular interest and a connection that is cemented in many different ways. It does also relate to the Jewish community in America, but I think it would still all be there even if the Jewish community wasn't there.
I think that's a perfect stopping point and a chance to give you some rest. Thank you very much.
Lovely to meet you.